You don't listen to our show, man.
Well, it would be helpful if I did, wouldn't it?
When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and joining me, as always, is Mr. Brian Reese.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year!
I can honestly say I wasn't expecting that.
Happy Holidays! And Merry Christmas to you, George Bailey, in jail. I might be misquoting that.
I think so.
Oh, I think it's Happy New Year, George, in jail.
I think we should go with...
If you get the reference, you get it. If you don't, that's cool, too.
I think we should go with Merry Christmas, you filthy animal.
Yeah, filthy animal.
Okay, today on the program, we'll be discussing the multi-layered musical extravaganza that is Kieran Gillen and Jamie McAvey's Phonogram. This will prove to be an interesting discussion.
Yes, well, I hope it should.
Oh, of course it will.
I mean, that's what we hope for, right, is an interesting discussion as opposed to the discussion which is not interesting and therefore repetitive and people wander off and start looking at porn.
Okay. I guess what I meant was intellectual.
Yes.
But we've already dropped the porn reference, so... Maybe intellectuals off the table.
Hey, we're already losing net neutrality, so the odds of people finding our podcast at this point going forward has reduced greatly.
Politics.
And no porn for you.
But first, typically at this point we talk about some of comic book news, but we're going to deviate from that a little bit because as we record this, you might have figured it out from Brian's opening that this is Christmas, or at least Christmas is right around the corner. And in addition to that...
Merry Christmas!
In addition
I'm just going to do that throughout this whole podcast, by the way, so yeah.
Okay. So in addition to that, Star Wars The Last Jedi has just been released in theaters. So to celebrate that, we have decided to talk about the wonderful, the infamous Star Wars Holiday Special. Oh. Now, Brian... You watched this for the first time, well, as an adult.
Not the first time. I did. I very specifically remember watching it as a kid.
Well, I mean, as an adult.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I had seen this very recently as well. Now, for anyone who doesn't know, this was a 1978 special that was aired on television. It is, I mean, George Lucas has abandoned it and denies it even exists. It has never been released on VHS or has it been released on VHS? I know it's not on DVD. It's definitely not on Blu-ray. You know
what? Part of me wants to guess. Now, we didn't do our homework on this because why would anybody in their right mind do their homework on this in terms of its release schedule? But part of me wants to guess it was on VHS, but on a digital platform outside of YouTube, who would spend the money?
It is my understanding that Lucas himself tried to track down every copy of this and destroy it. That's how much he hates this special.
Well, when George Lucas is exercising quality control...
Well, yes.
A man who has no concept of quality control, yes. When George Lucas is exercising quality control,
The man thought the prequels were pretty good, so this has to be pretty bad. So tell me, Brian, what do you think of the Star Wars Holiday Special?
Oh, wow. Okay.
That sums it up right there.
So as a kid, I remember watching it. Now, that is not to say I remember it. I remember watching it as a kid. Because in 1978, I would have been six or seven. I think six.
You can do math, right? You know how old you are now, right?
me and do good math. As a kid, I would have loved this. And my memory of watching this as a kid was loving it because it was Chewbacca. It was Han Solo. It was, sweet Jesus, it was Boba Fett. I didn't know who Boba Fett was. And it was like probably another year or so until I could turn in my proofs of purchase on my action figure cards to get that infamous Boba Fett action figure that was supposed to come, am I right, with the missile that actually worked.
Yeah. I think they put the kibosh on that pretty quickly.
I got that crappy Boba Fett that did not have the shooting missile on his back.
Well, the choking children usually.
Well, you know, thanks.
Yeah, put the kibosh on that. Yeah.
Thank you, overly concerned mothers. I mean, could we not sacrifice a few dead children for the sake of the rest of us enjoying a missile-shooting Boba Fett? My heavens, Paul. A way to ruin my childhood.
I'm sure you could get one on eBay now.
Yeah, I don't have $1,000 to just throw out on an action figure.
So the holiday special, for me, I remember watching it as well, and I distinctly remember that animation segment with Boba Fett, and I remember that, like, clearly. And I remember it being Star Wars. I do not remember any of the skits that are... Because essentially, this is a variety program with a Star Wars theme. Show. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just, wow. I mean, first of all, Art Carney is the Chewbacca family best friend.
He's their pal. He's watching out for them.
Yeah. He's actually, in all honesty, Art Carney's rather charming in this. He's not phoning it in. He's trying to make the material kind of fun.
I think he needed some work, but sure.
But, you know, but then also Harvey Korman's in it, who I don't think was trying very hard at all.
Oh, well, do we talk about the Harvey Korman blackface in this?
Oh, jeez. It was...
It's 1978. We get it. It's 1978.
You know what? It wasn't a good idea in 1978. That's just silly.
But it was like, it was Harvey Korman, not just blackface, but sort of homophobic. And, you know, just wow.
Lots of weird choices in this.
Yeah, standards very different in 1978.
I mean, at one point, Art Carney gives Chewbacca's, was his grandfather or his father, Itchy.
Itchy. Oh my God. Itchy and Lumpy.
Itchy and Lumpy. You know, you should go to the doctor anytime something's itchy and lumpy.
And Lumpy.
But Art Carney brings him some kind of virtual reality machine and basically plays him softcore porn.
Does what?
When Itchy's watching it, I forget the woman's name who sings the song. And Itchy's watching it.
Yeah, it's because it's Itchy. It's Grandpa.
Right. Right.
We're never sure if it's Chewbacca's father or Mala, Chewbacca's wife's father, right? I mean, it's one. Right. He's grandpa, right? No. And he is VR porn. Yes, to your point exactly.
It's really bizarre that this was aimed at kids.
Yes.
And you have someone saying, you know, I'm your desire. I'm your. Oh my God, it's truly stunning.
Oh yeah.
But
with the whole sparkly 70s, the production, bad production, you know, coloration behind.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely like heavy disco themed.
Right. Lots and of weird lights and kind of psychedelic, but not really psychedelic in the way that any of us who have had psychedelic moments really experience psychedelic.
Yeah. No, it's like a disco ball lights shining on you. And then there's so many weird choices in that. Jefferson Starship.
Oh my God. Like one of the worst songs ever written. Like people pick on Jefferson Starship or Starship at the time with We Built This City.
Oh yeah.
Like people are like, oh, We Built This City. That's the worst song of all time. It's like, no. No, I don't think that's the worst song of all time. I think the worst song of all time is the same band, only as Jefferson Starship, performing whatever that thing was that they did special.
I know. And they do.
And they're really serious about it, too. I mean, they're really earnest about this song.
Oh, I know. And I'm sorry. They shoot the opening in silhouette, and the singer, I don't know what the singer's name is, but he's holding a microphone that is one of the most phallic things I've ever seen. Right. And it's all in silhouette. It's just, again, this is for kids. What are you doing?
Well, there's a lot of, throughout the special, there's a lot of sexual innuendo.
Oh my God, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's all over the place. I think there's even like an eating fur reference. Wow. But all of that aside, I mean, the fact that Carrie Fisher, I understand, like, we shall say no bad about Carrie Fisher. I think I don't know when the Statue of Limitations, I don't know when we'll reach the Statue of Limitations with acknowledging that Carrie Fisher was like a coke fiend.
She acknowledged that she was a coke fiend. She's written about it herself. So I think it's on the table.
Every one of her scenes in this, she can barely stand. And there's a point, there was one point in there where her eyes go like completely opposite of each other. And she can barely read her lines.
Oh, come on. But the Life Day song is so pretty.
I mean, it's hilarious. And,
it really is.
Yeah.
And why was
Ford and Harrison Ford and Luke and Mark Hamill completely phoning it in?
Well, why was Mark Hamill wearing so much eyeliner?
Well, and he was well made up, and I don't know what was going on with the hair there. I didn't, we're not dudes who care about our hair that much, but it was. Wow. But
Luke Skywalker found himself a stylist, Jedi to the stars, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah. Just, oh, wow.
Well, and the Wookiees themselves. I mean, Lumpy, Itchy, and Mala. I mean, there's no wonder Chewbacca just wants to hang out with Han Solo all the time, because if that's the family he wants to return to.
Yeah, that's a, you know, that's a tricky situation, that Chewbacca just comes back once a year.
For Life Day.
So we have to deal with the fact that it's canon that
holiday special is Life Day.
Yeah. But it's canon. It's canon that Chewbacca is an absentee father.
Mm-hmm. So, and then when you meet his family, you know why.
Yeah.
Lumpy, the kid, is awful. I mean, what a little shit.
I don't know. Mala's pretty hot though. I do love the recycled Star Wars footage as well. There's one point where Darth Vader and, you know, a lackey are walking down talking about capturing Han Solo and Chewbacca.
Right.
And they didn't even care about lip sync in that. Just throw some voices over top of that scene.
And can we talk about the cartoon? Because the cartoon is, look at the people's eyes in the cartoon. Like, nobody blinks. And they're massive. They're wide. I mean, you're talking about, like, being coked up. I mean, I think the animators were like, we're like doing some serious lines going through this because
I don't know. I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that. That's one of the best parts of the whole special to me is that animation. Well, yes, it's weird and stylized, right. But you know,
you had all the phallic images of the creatures, you know, and or planktons.
Planktons.
Right. Yeah,
planktons are bananas. Yeah.
But the planktons as larger, they were plankton dinosaurs, right?
Yeah.
Who swam on this weird purple ocean.
It didn't, you know, it's something that would kind of fit in heavy metal.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
More than a Star Wars kids special. Now, but if Boba Fett
had said the word friend one more time, I think I was going to like throw a shoe at my TV.
Okay. But we're going to talk about, and you're going to disagree with me, I'm sure. But the scene with B. Arthur, I kind of like it. I think it's charming.
Well, it's very, you know what? It's very Waitsian, and by Waitsian, I mean Tom Waitsian. It's a bar song, right? I mean,
yeah. Well, it kind of had this kind of Berlin 1930s,
right?
You know, just before everything went to hell.
Well, you were expecting a little bit of decadence, right? I mean, it's Mos Eisley, so Mos Eisley is decadent. And B. Arthur's character, who we think is the owner of Mos Eisley.
Sure, why not?
Sure, I mean, sure, she's the owner. Yeah, I mean, you know, and she's getting hit on by one of Harvey Korman's three or four separate characters in this.
Yeah, Harvey Korman, I just,
And then they're supposed to be kicking everybody out, and so she's singing a song to all of her, you know.
Her patrons, her buddies. It's, right. You know, it's a farewell to friends.
But they're just closing for the night.
No, the Empire was shutting them down.
No, they were shutting them down. It was a curfew.
Oh, I thought they were shutting her down, like, permanently.
No, it was just a curfew for the night.
Oh, well, then that was a bit overdramatic then.
It was, I think it was just like, oh, you know, we're shutting everything down at this time of the night. But there was no indication that they couldn't open up the next day.
Oh, well, I misread that scene then.
So they couldn't stay open till 2, in the morning because, you know, on Tatooine, they have the same bar time as we do here in the United States of America.
Of course.
You know, bars
it's universal. It's a galactic standard.
Well, I live in
that
Chicago.
Bars stay open.
Right. But so in most places, you know, bar time is 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, right? So I think this was like an early closing. But then all of the people in the bar were just kind of dicks and I'm not leaving. And it's like, well, you know, I mean, what's up with that? Because they would leave if the Empire showed up, the stormtroopers showed up with guns and were like, well, you leave or I'm shooting you.
Now, see, that's why I thought they were shutting it down completely. And it makes it all more bittersweet that they're never going to have the place again. Kind of like the Wazzy Supper Club.
Like the Wazzy Supper Club. But I think ultimately they just had to close early and everybody had to leave. But there was nothing in the text that suggested that she wasn't just going to open up again the next day with a possibility of another, you know, so everybody's crying and having these palpitations of loss.
All right. Well, listen, we'll change it around. Let's pretend that it's closing forever because then okay. It makes the scene make much more sense. Anyway, I found it kind of fun and charming and she has a nice little song.
Right. And it's Bea Arthur.
Yes, and it's Bea Arthur. And then who there's Maud.
And it looks like she might get a little something-something by the end of the night.
I don't want to think about that.
Right? If we take anything from this holiday special, what we should take from it is a visual image of Bea Arthur knocking boots.
No, that makes me want to take a shower. A Golden Girl shower.
Oh, no. Do not cut that. Do not cut that.
So this special was an interesting...
It's terrible.
Yes, it's terrible. It's an interesting artifact of the time that someone must have put some thought into what they were going to do.
I don't know, Paul. Yeah. I'm not convinced anybody put thought into this.
Well, I think maybe it was, you know, there's a writer's room and everybody's just throwing out ideas. Well, we'll have Harvey Korman as a chef with four arms, and then we'll have Bea Arthur sing a song, and then, or maybe we could, and someone just said, yeah, all those ideas are great. Let's just do them all.
And let's have long extended scenes of Chewbacca's family making Chewbacca noises.
Yes, no subtitles.
With this weird music playing in the background for like 20 minutes. And the music, I don't even want to get into the music, but although our podcast today is ultimately about music, but...
That would have been a nice segue.
These long 20-minute scenes of just Lumpy and Itchy and Mala at each other.
Yes, it was an odd choice not to do any subtitles, don't you think?
There is actually, if you go online, there's a couple sites that have inserted subtitles.
The correct subtitles or their own subtitles?
I would highly recommend folks hunting those down where folks have actually inserted subtitles to these long scenes without them. I would say that folks have had a little bit of fun.
Okay, that makes sense. So would you recommend someone going out and watching this?
100%.
I would too. 100%.
I think anybody who has not seen this or has not seen this in a long period of time, I absolutely 100% recommend the Star Wars Holiday Special. Your holiday, this holiday, will not be complete. You're going to watch It's a Wonderful Life. You're going to watch Love Actually. You're going to watch White Christmas. You're going to watch Charlie Brown. I think that the Star Wars Holiday Special, readily available all over YouTube, should be essential viewing amongst those other classics.
I agree. Yeah. No. I think that everyone's holiday needs a moment to say, what the hell is going on? And that's what this special delivers. Just when you think you got it figured out, something even more bizarre happens.
And we didn't even touch the phenomenal acting. And I'm just going to leave that hang there because I think one needs to experience the great acting performances by everybody, not just the stars, but the entire cast. You really have to see it to properly believe it.
It's true.
And I think
like
that's
I said,
an accurate way.
Like I said, I do think Art Carney was trying his best to make it something interesting. But no one else was helping him out.
Him almost making out with Mala, though, was... Yeah, we'll just leave that hang there. And this is why you, our faithful audience should seek this out.
All right. The Star Wars Christmas or holiday special, A Thing to Behold.
That is a, yes, a thing to behold.
Okay. So let's move on, Brian. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk some Phonogram.
When you talk about comics, does it sound something like this?
Look, you can't put the Superman number 77s with the 200s. They haven't even discovered red kryptonite yet. And you can't put the number 98 with the 300s. Lori Lamaris hasn't even been introduced.
Or maybe it sounds a little more like this.
You think Mighty Mouse could beat up Superman? What are you, cracked? Why not? I saw the other day he was carrying 5 elephants in one hand.
Boy, you don't know nothing. Mighty Mouse is a cartoon. Superman is a real guy. No way a cartoon could beat up a real guy.
Yeah, maybe you're right. Would be a good fight, though.
Hello, I am the constantly caffeinated Clinton Robinson, and my comics discussions can go to both extremes, but generally fall somewhere in between. On the Coffee and Comics podcast, I will review comic stories and other comics-related topics that can be enjoyed over a cup of coffee. So pour the coffee, or other beverage of choice, and join me on the Coffee and Comics podcast, available on iTunes and coffeeandcomicspodcast.blogspot.com.
And we're back. Now, today on the program, we'll be talking about Phonogram. And since, Brian, this is your baby, take it away.
Okay, Paul. So what we're discussing today is Phonogram Rue Britannia, which is the first 6-issue series written by Karen Gillan and illustrated by Jamie McElvey. It was published by Image Comics between 2006 and 2007. Two further series followed, The Singles Club and The Immaterial Girl. Phonogram Rue Britannia is a magical musical quest, or a magical mystery tour, set in contemporary England, wherein the decade-old specter of Britannia, circa 1995 as the zeitgeist, thought dead and buried, is in danger of being revived for a third incarnation too soon, and the goddess of all music tasks phonomancer David Cole, a righteous asshole, with the recovery of Britannia's shade and the proper burial therewith. A phonomancer has the magical ability to manipulate persons in reality by invoking the lyrics or feel of a piece of music or a genre. David Cole embarks on his quest with the help of fellow phonomancer Emily Astor, his buddy Kid with Knife, and Indy Dave, a keeper of the Memory Kingdoms. Along the way, he receives help and hindrance from numerous names and faces of British pop rock, most importantly Luke Haynes of the Auteurs and Damon Albarn of Blur. Britannia is eventually recovered and saved / disposed of, but not without sacrifice of nostalgia and persona. A side story, and perhaps the most moving part of the story, is the appearance of the ghost of the still-living Beth, a former girlfriend of Cole's, who, in her 10 years past representation, is seeking the specter of Richie Edwards, the tragic member of Manic Street Preachers, who mysteriously disappeared in 1995, creating a myth of the Britpop movement and still lies unresolved. In this, Cole ultimately finds his redemption.
So there's a lot to unpack in this particular comic.
Yes.
Where would you like to start? I mean, obviously, the music is the thing that is all-encompassing. That's the big overall theme, and it's packed with references and so forth.
Right. I think the primary aspect of this is Gillan, ultimately, we're talking the crux of this story, which takes place 10 years later, is the 1994 to 1996 heyday of what is the Britpop movement. And the Britpop movement in England was sort of the callback, the rejection of American rock. And at the time, that would have been the Nirvanas and the grunge and sort of the very male, serious aspects of British or of American indie rock. Yeah. And the Britpop movement, to reduce it to a very generic, bland description, was a rejection of that and a hearkening back towards, let's say, the 60s British, the Brit invasion.
Yeah, I think it was a conscious decision, a conscious update of that 60s pop aesthetic, you know, right. translated into like a 90s club scene.
Yes. And it was a rejection of the sort of serious male driven angst that existed in American music at the time. And it was also very patriotic in many ways, yeah. which is referenced in the comic, is the sort of the Union Jack became a symbol within that movement. And of course, the major players within that movement were, well, the two players that everybody most remembers, of course, are Blur and Oasis.
Right.
And there was a lot of other things going on within that movement. Now, part of the appeal to this for me is, as Paul knows, and maybe a couple other readers know, it's not necessarily important, but I also have a second career as a music writer. And so I have a vested interest in comics or any kind of literature that discusses music as a cultural phenomenon, which Phonogram definitely plays upon.
Oh, definitely, without a doubt. Now, I personally was never a Britpop guy. Part of that stems from the fact that I was not in Britain at that time, but I was also very much engrossed in the grunge music, alt country, alt folk movements that were happening at the time, the very thing Britpop was attempting to be opposed to. And I didn't like, I mean, I didn't dislike Britpop. It just wasn't my thing at the time. I can retroactively see the good in it, but I remember being in the 90s, it just never was something that I was into.
Right. Well, I think we both had a very American response to it in some ways. Now, there were bands within that who were either part of, and again, Britpop existed pre-94 and post-96, but it is those kind of that two-year period within there that most folks felt it reached its heyday.
Grunge actually was exactly the same thing. The grunge movement in the 80s was actually much bigger and better, not bigger, but better than the popular grunge movement that happened in the 90s.
Right.
And that's similar to,
you know, Mudhoney was doing it long before.
Oh yeah. And yeah, the Pixies and yeah. But yeah. That we're not talking about that. But I just, you know, the actual Britpop movement before it got popular is pretty good, you know, in hindsight.
But I think with Phonogram and what it's attempting to look at is the mythology of that very small period of time in which, you know, 250,000 people went to an Oasis concert.
Which is sad.
Well, but it was also unique to, it's difficult as Americans, I think, to over or understate importance of the Britpop movement at that time, because we did not live it.
Right, yes.
And it did not necessarily speak to us as, you know, at that time I was like listening to Pavement or Superchunk or Guided by Voices or fill in the blanks or the Afghan Whigs, who are actually kind of a major player in how things turn out in this particular comic series.
But it's, yeah, as far as the comic book series is concerned, I mean, well, first of all, the metaphor that music is magic is, you know, on the nose, but it works really well. And it's a great jumping off point to tell this story. It's obvious that Kieran Gillen knows quite a bit about music, at least about that music.
And that shows throughout, like, his entire writing, throughout his oeuvre, as he has gone forward. You see it play out in even things like Journey into Mystery, which he wrote.
Well, he started as a music journalist.
And a gamer. I think he was a gamer journalist first.
Yes, I think so. But yeah, but so that he took that, I mean, that's essentially, that's a wonderful thing. He took those things that he was really engaged in and then wove a story around them. I mean,
right.
That's writing 101 right there. It's great. Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, it is a very simplistic story. I mean, it is a quest. It's a magical quest, only with fashion and set in a contemporary world. But it is, Phonogram is so great in how it incorporates the music, but not just the music, but the culture around the music, and fuses it into senses of nostalgia, a sense of self. I mean, David Cole, part of his concern is, so he is attempting to rescue slash save slash kill an aspect. And the aspect is Britannian. And Britannia, the aspect, is the representation of that Britpop sort of movement.
Right.
And Britannia was the one that created him, that made him a phonomancer. And his concern is that, besides the fact that he is holding on to that world and still has a root in that world, there's several instances where he talks about if she goes away or if her aspect is changed, Britannia's aspect is changed, then he changes and he ceases to be who he is, both by name and by persona.
And that is what intrigues me most, much more than the musical aspect. I mean, the musical aspect is the overarching theme, and that's the way to tell the story. The thing that interests me most about it is the idea of nostalgia and how what we remember can change in time. I mean, the idea that the past, and this is what happens with Cole, the idea that the past or a specific idea of the past can create our personality, and that our personality can change depending on how we remember it. That's a fascinating idea.
You're right.
And it's interesting that there's a continued through line, a continued notion in the story that you can realign your personality. They continuously tell other characters in the story continuously tell Cole that just root your personalities in a different time period or in a different type of music and forget about what happened before. So
right.
So you can change yourself depending how you depending on what you remember in the past.
And it wouldn't have to be the great thing about this is as you just referenced, it's the overarching. It doesn't have to be music.
Right.
It has to be whatever one has aligned oneself when they have become the persona that they are currently. Like, we all have a persona. I have a persona, you have a persona, and those personas are built upon our experiences, and particularly on the experiences that we most identify with.
Exactly. It's interesting. There's another part of these photomancers, which are retromancers,
right? Who we find out become are the big bads. Maybe they're not.
And again, these fascinating metaphors that Kieran Gillen is using is that these retromancers stay young by continuously reliving those moments. Right. Now, if you take that as like a psychological idea, just think of the one person who continues to think about that touchdown he threw in high school.
Right.
And he's always stuck in that one time period. For the terms of this story, it's these people are stuck in a particular time or a particular concert even. And they just relive that over and over again, trying to stay young. Again.
And trying to stay not just young, but relevant.
Relevant, yes. So there's a lot of really great intellectual, psychological ideas that are thrown on top of this. Because, on the surface, it looks like they're throwing in a lot of just music references and going from one fancy party scene to another. But there's so much, so many ideas weaved in inside there.
It's trying to understand what those things meant, and they're giving a meaning to a show or a meaning to a movement or a meaning to a moment to define themselves going forward. It's fascinating, and the fact that it's tied in with music, which I think music has always been one of those things that defines an age, and we all have a soundtrack to our lives. And for David Cole, the soundtrack to his life remains that 1994 to 1996, 1997 world. And everything that he feels or believes is a reaction to, we see so many scenes where he is talking about a particular record and what is happening when this particular record is playing.
Right. And ultimately, there's a lot of fear in that, mm-hmm. that he might lose that because it for some reason how that moment is remembered by others suddenly will change the way he remembers it.
Yes,
it's interesting that ultimately David realizes he isn't Britpop anymore, it doesn't define him, but it is a base of operations. It's a starting point that he built from. That's kind of the loyalty that he has to the god, you know, in the story, the goddess Britpop. That's right. Why he has such loyalty to it. It's not that he wants to be there forever. It's that it helped define who he is today.
And he doesn't know where else he's supposed to be. There's that great scene where he's talking about, like, at the time that this comic came out in 2006, which was 10 years. I mean, it seems very intentional that this was 10 years after sort of what folks thought was the death of Britpop. It is interesting that it is 10 years later. He's talking to, like, there's that great scene where he's sitting in Primrose Hill or outside of Primrose Hill, and the kid comes up to him and asks for a smoke, and the kid is a Libertines fan. The Libertines are generally regarded to as a bit of shite, but
they're also specifically post Britpop.
Right. And also the reference to the Arctic Monkeys. Now, no one listening to this has to know who these bands are, but what they do have to know is that these bands are very much in antithesis to the world that David Cole is still hanging on to. And he talks to a young kid who bums a smoke off of him, and he tries to relate, and he can't.
Yes. Well, it should be noted that he is very much a music snob, too.
Right. And I personally as a music snob, this series speaks to me because I am and have been accused by many of being a bit of a music snob. So I understand, you know, when I read this, if anybody out there is listening and they've had this moment where they feel like their taste is sort of elevated from what others do, you get this scene. And it doesn't mean that David Cole is right. It doesn't mean that the kid who likes Libertines is right. And Cole goes through like a whole internal monologue about why this guy is wrong, but at the same time, why it's okay that he's wrong and maybe he's right. It's a great internal monologue that he has in that scene. And this is what leads to him being able to go and ultimately free Britannia and also let her go at the same time.
Yeah, and that's that's the wonderful part about it, is that, you know, the ultimate resolution to this story is that you remember it the way you remember it, and it doesn't change who you are. You know, it helped define you at that time, and those memories helps you move forward. There's many people in the many characters in the story that keep saying, stop looking backwards, look forward.
Right. And he's not able to until he is, I guess. I mean, there is a resolution to this comic, even though there's two more series that have come about. And I think one of the most important aspects of the series is, I mean, there's so many great things, and we haven't, you know, I think Indie Dave is a great character because he's not a retromancer. He's a guy stuck in 1979, 1980, and he's Indie Dave because he is, you know, when we first meet him, he's listening to Joy Division.
Yeah.
And he's throwing 7 inches onto a fire. There's a famous one where he throws a lush 7 inch onto the fire. But he is also the key to the memory kingdom.
Well, that...
the memory kingdom is where there's a whole scene. It's for people listening to us going, what the hell are you talking about? There's a scene where there is a character named Indie Dave. And as part of David Cole's quest to find Britannia and save her, he is sent to visit Indie Dave, who is a phonomancer who can find his way into what is called the memory kingdom. And Indie Dave says, you can't go into the memory kingdom. It's a magic. It's a magic of going into someone else's memories. And he tells David Cole specifically, do not go into your own memories. You have to go into somebody else's memories.
Well, specifically, a memory kingdom is the culmination of how, you know, it's how everyone remembers it.
Right.
So it's the consensus memory.
Yes.
Which is fascinating as well, because how I remember something from the past might not be how you remember it, but somewhere along the line, there's a consensus of, right, you know, the 60s are remembered a certain way and have a certain aesthetic. So, that's just another fascinating little tidbit in there.
Right.
So continue. I'm sorry. I stepped on
you. No, that's just, it's, But it is good. Like, so he warns David Cole against going into David Cole's own memories. Because he said, Indy Dave himself says that he could not sustain it if he went into his own memories. But David Cole ends up going into his own memories, which is what causes a bit of there is a bit of conflict in there, which involves Damon Albarn of Blur, which is kind of a hilarious bit. But even better is the Luke Haynes, who many think is the creator of Britpop, but also the great scourge of Britpop, as the guide throughout this. And it's Luke Haynes who gives David Cole the final piece of advice. And I'm not going to say what that is, but it's Luke Haynes of the Alters who gives David Cole the last piece of advice that sets him on his final path.
Yeah, Luke Haynes is the Virgil to his Dante.
Yes, through this. Right.
Yeah, I believe that's even referenced in the story. And then another fascinating concept that is thrown in these memory kingdoms is the empty, faceless crowd.
Right.
You know, the crowd as a unified, anonymous thing, empty, devoid of any kind of personality. But Cole ultimately rejects that out of hand as a construct of the future looking back. And what he remembers is individuals coming together for a shared experience, not what, you know, we're told to remember.
Right.
Well, I agree with that, actually.
Yeah, it's why Britpop is actually sort of a great metaphor in many ways for all of this, because there's a disagreement as to what it was. Was it, as I said earlier, 250,000? As I said earlier, and as was said in the comic, was it 250,000 people in a field, or was it a loose collection of people in a small club in Camden Town? You know, and it's what was it, and what exactly? And these are questions that the comic asks, but asks in an entertaining comic book kind of way, not in a, you know, we're not reading Nietzsche.
Thank God.
but it's almost as I feel it's as relevant in terms of, because it's framing it in a way that is not too dense to get through. We're making it sound more dense than it really is.
Well, no, and this is a great example of the comic book medium, because it shows with words and pictures, it invokes music, and that's something very unique to comics in general, is the way that it can create moods and feelings. It's something that no other medium can do, I think. You can disagree with me on that one, but
I do not.
You know, but the way the art, I think the art is very basic. It's very stylized, but it's simple. But there's emotion to it, you know. Right.
And we haven't even talked about the art yet, because Jamie McKelvey does.
I think I just did.
You just brought it up, but it took us this long to get to the great art.
It's perfect for what it is. I mean, first of all, it's black and white, which adds a stark, you know, I want to say a harshness, because it's actually kind of smooth and simple.
It's pop. It's very popish. Intentionally.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's very much an indie comic at the time, you know, that style of black and white.
But if you really pay attention to what McKelvey's doing in his art, I mean, there's so many, like, interesting things that happen on the peripheries. And even the people that he creates, I mean, there's a lot of crowd scenes, and some of them are very blatant references to other musicians, which you don't have to get if you don't get it, but if you get it, it just adds an extra layer. But then there's all these kind of things happening, and some of it I don't get because it's very referential. But the lines that he does, and sort of the facial things that McKelvey does, I think are really great.
Oh, I agree. And like you said, you know, there's so many references. There's pretty much every obscure indie act or any British act you can think of is referenced in some capacity, many of which I probably missed. But that did not take away from the story itself. There's many times, and I think I told you this off mic, that I could come to a part and go, I know that's a reference. I don't know what the reference is, but I know that it's a reference. And it's one of those things where I want to look it up later.
Right.
And that's
in the same way that every cover, each issue, the cover is a classic record. It's a reference to a classic record of the time, and just phenomenally well done. Just
absolutely
really amazingly well rendered with its own unique character, which I love.
Yeah. So it's, you know, as a whole, this is a really wonderful piece, and it continues on further in the two volumes that follow
in the two following volumes, which have their own sort of where David Cole is not a major player.
Yeah, he's not the main focus anymore,
because he's had his redemption, whatever that redemption ultimately is, and that's up for the reader to determine for themselves. I would not wish to say specifically,
but it should, you know, without giving, well, you talked about it in the synopsis, that ending with Beth is just a tender, heartwarming, wonderful culmination of this whole story. There's that one panel where she's in bed with her new husband, and she just turns, and after hearing a song on the radio, it's a Manic Street Preachers song on the radio, and she's able to enjoy it.
Right.
She rolls
it's
over.
The motorcycle.
And, yeah.
Yeah. It's the motorcycle Manic song.
So she rolls over and she just hugs her husband, and it's lovely. It's so tender.
But yeah. I think not to keep us from wrapping this up too quick, but I feel like the Beth storyline needs to be addressed a little bit, if in acknowledgement of what you just said. But I don't think that any of this can be talked about without the ghost of Richie Edwards. And for those who aren't familiar, Richie Edwards was the guitarist and songwriter for the Manic Street Preachers. And he mysteriously disappeared one night. I don't have the date in front of me, but I believe it was 1995.
It was not too far off from when Kurt Cobain killed himself.
Right. And eventually, one should look up Richie Edwards, look up the Wikipedia or whatever else they want. But the Manic Street Preachers were a movement in and of themselves, separate from Britpop and separate from virtually anything else. Now, I'm not a big fan of theirs. I wasn't for their earliest their Richie Edwards years, and I was not a big fan during the post Richie Edwards years either. But as a pop icon, he was the closest that they got to Kurt Cobain. And the problem with Richie Edwards is they never got closure. He literally disappeared. Now, most people think he committed suicide. It was on a bridge. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that he committed suicide. But
I believe
eventually his family got him declared dead. But he's still, you know, no body was ever found. So where is Richie Edwards? And there's a great moment in the comic where they talk about, where David Cole is talking about, Richie's not dead, Richie's not alive, Richie's gone.
Well, first of all, it's a lovely sentiment, but it also says so much about the nostalgia, the overarching nostalgia theme that this comic has been talking about.
Right.
If you take away the idea of Richie, just, you know, it's not, it's just gone. It's not dead. It's not changed. It's just gone.
Yeah. It's not alive. It's not dead. It's just gone.
Exactly.
And you know, at the end, you know, because when he first, the ghost of Beth is looking for a Richie, the real Beth has given up on music altogether. Like when he meets up with Beth in current times, she had been a huge Manix fan, and
it hurt her so much that
I just listen to the radio.
Yeah, that hurt her so much that it does. She doesn't feel for music anymore, which is what makes that that moment at the end even more bittersweet. Is when she hears the song, she enjoys it
because he convinced the ghost of her to follow Richie wherever he went, and exactly. He does it in a very phonomancer way, mm-hmm. and a manipulative way. But you know, when you have a ghost of someone who's still alive, and it's a ghost of someone who is an aspect of what someone used to be. And by freeing that ghost, he freed Beth in modern times to be able to hear a song and know the song without it just being a generic pablum on the radio.
Or it's not hurtful. It's not anything. It's just, she's able to let go of her past, which is, again, really great ideas, great metaphors.
But she's able to let go of it and at the same time still have it.
Exactly.
And still hold on to it.
And David Cole does the does a similar thing with his. Right. Yeah. And I find it very interesting because David Cole's a dick, you know.
Right.
He's not a good guy. Admittedly so. He says it point blank that he is not a good person. And a lot of people tell him that as well. And it's funny that his story arc basically is he goes from a complete dick to not so much of one.
Yeah. He's less of a dick. And part of that is, you know, it's a person can only redeem themselves. So, which is why he can't go from a complete dick to a savior. That's not his job, is to be a savior. His job at the end was to facilitate as opposed to save.
Right.
And so he's still a dick. He's just less of a dick. Yeah.
So if you're going to have a character arc, that's a good enough one for this. But overall, yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I would also be remiss if I just want to give one. I know we're wrapping this up and we have some final thoughts, what have you. But I think it's very important for us to at least give a shout out to Kid with Knife.
Yep.
Because Kid with Knife is the best character in Phonogram.
And well, I'm sorry.
The less I say about him, the better, because one should read Phonogram just to enjoy Kid with Knife.
Yeah. Kid with Knife is probably one of the most authentic characters in the entire book. He's not trying to impress anybody. He just is who he is. But the one important thing you should take away from Kid with Knife is always have a friend who drives.
Exactly.
This is overall just it's an example of how great comics are.
Yes.
It's really, really just takes the medium.
Too. I think that's the other thing. We have to make sure that people know that this is fun. This is not a slog. This is not a difficult read. This is a lot of fun. You could read into it as much as you want, or you can read it at a surface and enjoy it just as much.
Yeah. You could read it for just the music. You can read it for the philosophy. You could read it as just a fun look.
A magical quest. It's a magical
quest. Yeah,
it is. It's a magical mystery tour.
And I like that the actual magic, you know, the spells and whatnot are intentionally left vague.
Right.
You know, that works well. You don't need to know the intricacies of the way the magic works to understand the story. It's just know that music is magic, and that's all you need to know.
Yes.
Anything else to add, Brian?
I don't. I actually have a million things to add, but we don't have an extra 2 hours. So I think people should read this and
absolutely
get their own 2 to 5 to 20 hours worth of thoughts on the matter themselves.
Indeed. So before we go, I just want to say that we'll be taking a little break for Christmas and New Year's, but we will have an episode as a filler to bridge the gap between this episode and the next new content. So the next episode will be sort of a clip show. Brian and I have a tendency to ramble.
You're kidding.
It's true. We don't actually stay focused all the time. So I've put together some excerpts from past episodes of the discussions that were off the cuff or came before or after the original recording, or just stuff that was so off topic it didn't make the final cut. But they're fun, and I hope they're entertaining, and I did want to just fit them in somewhere. So the next episode will be the collected edition clip show.
All right. That won't be embarrassing at all.
That being said, our next official episode will be Star Wars related, because I'm all about Star Wars right now. So Brian, I am going to recommend Heir to the Empire, the first volume of Timothy Zahn's Thrawn trilogy. Now, this was originally published by Dark Horse. It's subsequently been absorbed into Marvel's Legends collections. But for our purposes, let's just consider this Dark Horse.
Okay.
So that's Heir to the Empire, the Thrawn trilogy, volume 1. I think you've never read this before, have you?
I have not. This will be new to me.
Yes, it'll be fun. These novels, these are actually adaptations of the novels by Timothy Zahn. And Thrawn as a character has become a fan favorite and showing up in Rebels and having spin-off material like other comics and novels and stuff. So like I said, it'll be a lot of fun. So I guess that's it for this episode.
That is.
Yeah. Cheers, everybody. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. Have a great holiday. And as always, keep reading comics.
And happy holidays to everybody else as well. And be well as always.
Goodbye. You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter at the Daddy Elk Productions handle @DaddyElk and use the hashtag Collected Edition. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year!